of Ahlul Bayt during the days of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Today, we're examining a little-known process that's being used to build support for the Zionist regime. I was shocked to recently discover that Jewish children in the UK, as young as 4 or 5, are being encouraged to support Zionism, the official racist ideology of the Israeli regime. Later in the show, I'll be speaking to experts about this unethical practice to find out more. But first, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation into how Zionist groups are trying to indoctrinate Jewish youngsters to support the racist ideology of Zionism.
In occupied Palestine, the resistance faces the Zionist entity daily. It faces the military, the settler movement, a racist political system, and cruel state bureaucracy. These institutions depend on support from outside the Zionist entity. The Zionist movement is engaged in long-term planning to build that support. This is a process of turning young Jews outside Palestine into partisans of Zionism. It is a process of grooming young people to radicalize them. This is a real threat to national security in every country that the strategy is used. It educates, trains, and prepares young Jews to have a primary loyalty to the Zionist entity and encourages them to commit, practically, to the racist state ideology of the entity, Zionism. How does this work? The most obvious way is by funding many thousands of young Jews from age 18 to 32 to go on free propaganda tours to the Zionist entity, so-called birthright tours, or the Israel Experience tours for 16 to 18-year-olds. In reality, no Jew living in the UK or US has any birthright to the land of Palestine. But this racist settler colonial narrative is openly advertised by Zionist groups, including the most mainstream Zionist groups like the United Jewish Israel Appeal in the UK, the largest Zionist fundraising group. Less obvious are the radicalization processes adopted for children at much younger ages. In fact, indoctrination starts as young as 4 or 5 years old when children begin primary school. The UJIA refers to their approach as building a lifelong connection to Israel. They begin by school exchanges with Israel, aiming to normalize the Zionist entity. This is not just directed at Jewish kids, but also at non-Jews in comprehensive education settings, for example, in Glasgow. There is even a special program to infiltrate Israeli citizens into British settings, including primary and secondary schools. Survey respondents overwhelmingly agreed that these agents of a hostile foreign power enhanced connection to Israel, understanding of Israel, and knowledge of its history. But it's not just external Zionist groups. Some schools are themselves openly committed to promoting the racist ideology of Zionism. For instance, the Hartsmere Jewish Primary School in North London says it is Zionist, and nearby Yavna College in Elstree, North London, advertised itself as a religious Zionist school under the heading Me and My Land. But British Jewish children have no right to the so-called Land of Israel. They boast of inviting extremist Zionist groups to indoctrinate the pupils, including Mizrahi UK and Stand With Us. They are taught how to be a positive advocate for Israel. The penetration of British society by the racist Zionist movement is not accomplished by just external lobby groups, but is integrated into the structure of British society, beginning in primary schools.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Tony Greenstein. Tony's a long-standing anti-Zionist activist and a founding member of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. He's a prolific blogger and a veteran opponent of fascism. He wrote A History of Fighting Fascism in Brighton and the South Coast, and he's about to publish a new book titled Zionism During the Holocaust. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. I mean, are Zionist groups really trying to indoctrinate primary school kids?
Yes, they are. I mean, this United Jewish Israel Appeal, the biggest Zionist fundraiser in this country, is engaged with this, what it calls this Lifetime Connections program, which starts from 4 to 11 in primary schools. They're active in a school in Glasgow, which is a non-denominational school, but which has quite a large number of Jewish students in it. And they bring in their pro-Israel stuff to that school to Jewish and non-Jewish kids. So they're proselytizing about Zionism to British kids in general. So it's extraordinary. I mean, they're... We wouldn't be allowed to do this if it was Palestine or if it was any other issue of political conflict. But in this case, it seems to be accepted without question.
Mm. Tony, what's your experience of indoctrination into Zionism? Do you have any sort of personal experience of that?
Well, I went to a Jewish school, the King David School in Liverpool, from the age of 11 onwards. And yes, the Zionist Federation and the various institutions had a stranglehold on the school. I mean, they had a shaliach, that is an emissary, an overseas emissary from Israel, who was a teacher there. And there were other Israeli teachers who came and went. But yes, the whole atmosphere was about support for Zionism. It was taken for granted. We never heard even the word Palestinian. This is back in the 60s, of course, but the Palestinians were just Arabs, and all we knew was that they just didn't want to make peace with Israel for some strange reason.
Yeah, indeed. So it was really like a process of indoctrination then.
Oh, yeah, socialisation and indoctrination, yes. I mean, my experience, I mean, one of the reasons I broke from Zionism early was the headmaster, who was bitterly criticised, decided to have a debate in the school debating society on Zionism, right or wrong, and I played the devil's advocate.
Right.
And in the process of researching the talk, I found out that all the stuff I'd been taught and learnt was a myth.
Right, interesting, yeah. I wonder how many other young Jewish kids go through a similar journey as you, Tony, but well done for certainly doing that. But David, I mean, tell us a bit more about this Hartsmere Primary School and Yavne College that were mentioned in the film, and what's the connection between the EHRC, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, and to Bristol University as well?
Well, these two schools have a governor in common. It's a woman called Rebecca Hilsenrath, who you might remember this, Chris. At the time of the complaint about the Labour Party to the Equality and Human Rights Commission, that she was the chief executive officer, and she was in charge of the complaint for some months before she recused herself. So she's the governor of these schools, which describe themselves, self-describe, as Zionists. So that's an extraordinary state of affairs in itself, and should really have disqualified her from any involvement with the Labour Party complaint from the very beginning. But she only recused herself sometime later, and for nebulous and very, very unclear reasons. So that's the first connection. The second connection is that the president of the Bristol Jewish Society, a student society, when they took the complaint against me back in 2019, well, she went to Yavne College. So, I mean, just in my own case, we see the process of indoctrination. They come out of these schools, they then take leading roles in Jewish societies and universities. They go on to take national roles, which this particular person did. She became the president of the Union of Jewish Students. And then off they go into politics to pursue Zionism for the rest of their political careers. So this is an ongoing process. It starts, yes, in primary school, but it goes all the way through. There's a whole process of indoctrination all the way through till they're adults.
Tony, tell us a bit more about this Birthright organisation. I mean, are they really suggesting that all Jews have a birthright to the land in Palestine?
Oh, absolutely. That is the myth that Zionism is founded on, that the Jews were expelled from Palestine in 2000, at the time of Christ, which is not
2000
correct.
2,000 years ago, yeah.
2,000 years ago, yes. And that they are now returning. Of course, it's a complete nonsense. I mean, you can't claim to return to a place after 2,000 years. In any case, there is no connection between... I mean, Judaism sees Jerusalem as the centre of its religion, but it's a religious connection. There's no biological, genetic or any other racial connection whatsoever. In fact, the direct descendants of the ancient Hebrews are the Palestinians who lived there, and Ben-Gurion accepted that.
Yes, indeed. It's interesting. Yeah, the Zionists kind of passionately making this case that somehow this kind of 2,000-year heritage is really curious, isn't it?
Well, if they came across the ancient Hebrew tribesmen today, they would be shot on sight as terrorists.
Indeed.
I mean, that's the irony. It's a racial myth, nothing more.
No, indeed. But David, I mean, some of these schools are boasting, aren't they, that they're bringing extremist groups into the classroom, including assets of the Zionist regime. I mean, how do they get away with this?
Well, it's curious, isn't it? I mean, one of the organisations we saw there was Stand With Us, which is an organisation which was set up and took money from the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Its UK branch is funded entirely by its US branch, which came out of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs anti-BDS work. So this is effectively an agent or an asset of a hostile foreign power of the State of Israel, which is brought into schools to give talks as if they're somehow politically neutral. They're clearly not politically neutral. They have a particular take on the question and should be nowhere near schools except in the context of debate.
Mm. Does Ofsted have anything to say about this kind of thing?
They don't appear to know. I mean, you might recall last May when there was the attack on Gaza and on Al-Aqsa Mosque, that there was a letter from the Education Secretary saying that schools shouldn't be having discussions about Palestine, and if they were to have discussions about Palestine, they should use these particular three organisations, which he listed, all of which, of course, it turned out, were Zionist organisations. So they actually don't see this as a problem at all. These Zionist organisations go into schools anyhow, and then whenever anyone talks about the Middle East, we can't have a pro-Palestinian organisation, we can't have any organisation criticising Zionism, we can only have Zionist organisations as if they give a balanced debate, which, of course, they don't.
Mm, it's an incredibly partial position that they take, isn't it?
Especially given it's not just in secondary schools where kids are sort of starting to learn
indeed
questions about political debate, but
course,
at a primary school, as if this is just common sense.
Sure.
And it's not common sense.
Yeah,
this is a highly partial set of arguments which pursue the foreign policy objectives of a hostile foreign state, and they're taken in schools as if they're just unexceptional.
We'd think the minimum that would give students, the opportunity to hear, another version, if you like, of the truth. But Tony, just before we go to the break and the next video, I mean, some Jewish communal and religious institutions are actually explicitly signed up to Zionism, aren't they?
Well, most of them are. The organised communal organisations, like the Board of Deputies, the Jewish Leadership Council and so on, have in their constitutions support for Israel.
Mm.
So that therefore means they defend Israel, right or wrong.
Sure.
And so in the context of education, you get brought up to believe that in 1948, the Palestinians ran away to let the Arab armies in. They voluntarily left. In fact, we were told that the Zionists begged them to stay, but they wouldn't, you know.
Has this support for Zionism always been a feature of Jewish communal and religious organisations in this country?
Oh, no. I mean, when Zionism first came to Britain, the Jewish bourgeoisie, including the chief rabbi, Sir Hermann Adler, they opposed it vehemently as being opposed to the Jewish religion.
Yes.
They said it was a secular heresy.
Sure.
But, of course, when the British ruling class adopted Zionism, the Jewish leaders fell into line slowly but surely.
Yeah.
But no, most Jews at the beginning of the 20th century, they saw Zionism as really a form of Jewish anti-Semitism.
There's been a real shift. Well, let's just pause there for a moment anyway. Report about how Zionist indoctrination seems to have given rise to a peculiarly racist brand of comedy.
The very significant investment in indoctrination made by the Zionist movement, including by the United Jewish Israel Appeal, the main UK fundraising body for ethnic cleansing in Palestine, has clear impact. The investment in scores of organizations for young people, youth and young adults works its way through the society and props up the racist ideology of Zionism and legitimizes ethnic cleansing in Palestine. But it also schools and coaches young Jews in wider racist ideas and ideologies. How does this work out when they grow up? Take the example of a school in North London, the Haberdashers Axe School, now known more simply as Haberdashers. Significant number of nationally and internationally known entertainers attended the school, including Matt Lucas and Ashley Blaker, who are behind the popular comedy show Little Britain. David Baddiel, the stand-up comedian and key participant in the anti-Semitism smears against the left over the past 5 years. Perhaps best known is Sacha Baron Cohen, who made his name blacking up as a young Muslim, Ali G, pretending to be black, and then played a series of other Muslim comedy characters, including Borat, in the internationally known film of the same name. Work produced by all four has regularly been condemned for racism. Little Britain was widely criticized this year as racist when some old shows were made available for streaming again. After George Floyd was murdered, the shows were pulled from Netflix. Baddiel famously blacked up and taunted the black football player, Jason Lee, in a series of primetime comedy shows. Lee later said that Baddiel had never properly apologized for the damage he did. Baron Cohen has been widely criticized for decades for the racism of his portrayal of Muslim characters. It has been said that the school might be the origin of these creative talents, often referred to in the media as the Elstree School of Comedy. But many of those involved, such as Baddiel and Baron Cohen, also credit a little-known Zionist youth group, Habodim Dror, as playing a role in their success. Socialist Zionist group, Habodim Dror, is one of the many Zionist youth groups financially supported by the UJIA. According to press reports, it's had an extraordinary track record as a hothouse which produced significant figures in the arts and entertainment industry. Perhaps it should be known as the Habodim School for Racist Comedy.
David, tell us a bit more about the school that changed its name to remove the reference to a slave owner.
So Haberdashers asks, it's not a Jewish school, it's an elite private school, very expensive to go to if you want to send your kids there. Right. I'm not going to tell you how much because you'll, you know,
it's a lot.
It's a lot, and it's produced a huge number of people some from politics, but from arts and entertainment. We listed a few of them in the film there, but there's tons more, and they also have a functioning Jewish society at the school. And the president of the Jewish society at the school before he came to the University of Bristol was a guy called Edward Isaacs, who became the president of the Jewish society in Bristol University. So another connection here. So, but the people who've gone there, including Matt Lucas and Ashley Blaker, who are behind Little Britain. Many of them have returned to, you know, to do, you know, appearances at the school as old boys, alumni, that kind of thing. Right. And it's said, you know, the press says, you know, so many people from the entertainment world come from this school. It's a sort of school for entertainment. Well, you know, actually, what was interesting, I think, in looking at this film, was the way in which many of the people who were involved there were also in this Habanim Dror, the Zionist organization. And so it's a kind of curious thing that they've kind of produced this school of comedy, which would appear to have some kind of affinity with racism. And you know, you can't see the necessarily a direct connection, but there's some kind of curious thing going on there.
Mm. I mean, Tony, it seems rather odd to me, anyway, that this Habanim Dror, which claims to be a socialist Zionist youth group, produced this kind of racist comedy. Does it seem odd to you?
No, not in the slightest. There is really no such thing as socialism.
Well, I should have said socialist.
Socialist Zionism. Yeah, you could be a socialist, you could be a Zionist. You can't be both at the same time. But no, not at all. The socialist Zionists, or the left Labour Zionists in Palestine historically, were more racist than the right-wing Zionists, because the right-wing Zionists would employ Palestinians as cheap labour. Mm. The Labour Zionists wanted to exclude them entirely. Mm. So left and right in Zionism is really meaningless. And it doesn't surprise me that the racist caricatures of Arabs comes from the left Zionists primarily. And that's what David Baddiel, who blacks up and who finds it funny to imitate the hair of black people and so on, Jason Lee, the footballer, who he mimicked and, persecuted, really.
They did.
But Baddiel is a particularly horrific racist, but he still appears on British television.
Oh, he does.
Keir Starmer's favourite Jew.
Absolutely. a very sort of prominent Zionist advocate, as far as I can see. But, I mean, David, this... I see that the United Jewish Israel appeal was mentioned in our reports. I mean, what's its role in all of this?
So, we've mentioned it several times. This is the biggest Zionist fundraising organization in the country, and it's part of in Israel. It's part of the national institutions. There are four national institutions which make up the head of the Zionist movement, and the UJIA in Israel, called Keren Hesod, is a key part of that, and it raises funds for the occupation of Palestine, for settler colonialism in Palestine. Mm. And it's not really known about in this country. I mean, people do know, I think, a little bit about the Jewish National Fund, which was involved in expropriating land in Palestine. But the UJIA is the biggest of the organizations. It's coming for really very little criticism. And it's involved in funding all of these youth organizations we've been looking at and many other organizations, including funding some of the schools we've been talking about, the Zionist schools. This is an attempt to indoctrinate the entire society with pro-Israel narratives, and yet it escapes almost all criticism and scrutiny. So I'm really saying we should be looking at more and much more at this organisation.
Yeah,
it's headed by almost all of the key fundraisers for the Zionist movement in this country, names which some of which you will know. And it should be really in the crosshairs of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, in addition to other organisations like the JNF.
No, indeed. Well, we've shone a bit of a light on it today, yes, obviously we need to do more. But I mean, Tony, in addition to Habanim Dror, there's quite a variety of Zionist youth groups, aren't there? I mean, what can you say about them?
Well, they all support a Jewish state, which means a Jewish supremacist state. So they will differ on tactics. I mean, there's the right wing one historically was Betar of Herut, now Likud, and in the 1930s. It's young people trained with Mussolini forces in Civitavecchia, the naval port in Italy, and then transferred to the Polish fascists after Mussolini allied with Hitler. But I was a member of B'nai Akiva, which was the religious Zionist group. And before 1967, they weren't particularly nationalist. I mean, they were more religious. But after 1967, the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, they moved to the far right. They became the Messianic Jews who believed that God wouldn't come back until they'd conquered every inch of Palestinian territory and expelled the Palestinians or made them into slaves. That's a condition on which they can stay. So, yes, I mean, but they're all the same. I mean,
the process of it seems to me, anyway, from what you're saying, a kind of process of indoctrination it seems to be kind of endemic with these organisations.
Yes, I mean, you're socialised into it. Accept Zionism as a norm.
Quite difficult to
The Arab is the other. You don't really discuss them. They're invisible. But for all colonialism, the indigenous population was invisible.
No, indeed. I mean, David, is there a kind of old boys network going on here where, you know, you get sort of former members of Zionist youth groups kind of helping each other out in later life? Is that how it works?
Well, you can see that in some of the meetings that are held at the Habs Boys School, where the old boys come back and they give them advice on careers and that kind of thing. Yeah. But also, it would appear that they do this through careers. I mean, in the BBC, for example, there's a guy called Dan Patterson, both from Habs Boys and from Habanim Dror, who did Mock the Week. And Baddiel says in an interview somewhere in the papers that in his early days he would come along to these meetings to be commissioned to write jokes. And Dan Patterson said at the end, Betorum, which is the dismissed statement that you would get at the end of the Habanim Dror meetings. And he realised that he was a former Habo and that he could get in there and to discuss things with him. So according to Baddiel's own account, there's a sort of elective affinity there that people, they help each other out through later careers. And this is how Zionist ideas are replicated in adult life.
Sure. It really is like an old boys network then, from what you're saying. But Tony, what do you make of the allegations of racism that's been made against the likes of David Baddiel and others? I mean, you think is it fair to link that to Zionism? From what David's saying, it certainly does seem fair. I mean, what's your thoughts?
Well, yes, because black people and Arabs really are the untermentioned in a sense. So Baddiel started his career blacking up as indeed a black person, and then making himself into the object of a joke, I mean, which he transferred to people like Jason Lee, the famous footballer.
Yes, indeed.
And I think other comedians have done likewise who are Zionists as well. Sacha Baron Cohen, for example,
yes,
also blacking up. So, yes, I mean, this was a staple of music hall comedy in Britain and America in the 30s and the 40s. And again, it had racist roots in the Deep South. So, I mean, that's the tradition they come from. But if you think of Israel today, it's a replica of the Deep South in it with its Jim Crow laws.
I mean,
if you're a Palestinian, you can't live in most of Israel. It's barred, you know. Hundreds of Jewish communities are Jewish
shocking
only.
Well, listen, I'm afraid we are out of time. Thank you, Tony, for joining us today and giving us the benefit of your knowledge. And obviously, thanks again to David, our resident expert. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Line. 100 days after the killing of journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh, the Biden administration has failed to launch an investigation. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alice Sperry, writer. This article is published under the heading Biden ignores the injustice of Israeli regime killing of a Palestinian-American journalist. Here's the story. Days after Israeli regime forces killed Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh, the Biden administration has made no concrete effort to secure accountability for her killing, nor has it moved to independently investigate it despite dozens of members of Congress calling on the administration to do so. Abu Aghaleh, an Al Jazeera journalist and a household name across the West Asia region, was killed on May 11th while reporting on an Israeli regime military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. She was shot in the head while wearing a clearly visible press vest, standing nowhere near the fighting that had taken place earlier that morning. The killing was swiftly condemned by human rights and press freedom groups across the world. Within weeks, half a dozen independent investigations, including one by the United Nations, concluded that the bullet that killed her came from Israeli regime forces, with the UN noting that it had been well aimed. But U.S. officials have yet to take any concrete action over the killing by the Zionist regime of a U.S. citizen, and it's unclear whether they have any plans to do so. Last month, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with members of Abu Aghla family in Washington, D.C. after the request to meet President Joe Biden during his July trip to the West Asia region went unanswered. Blinken made no commitments to them other than greater transparency and more direct communication, which he promised after the family members noted that they were learning of U.S. statements on the killing from the news rather than directly from U.S. officials. Lina Abu Aghla, Shirin's niece, told The Intercept in an interview recently, "There were no promise made, no commitments. We expressed our concern, we expressed our disappointment with the way the United States has been handling the killing of Shirin, and we express how ridiculous it is that the family of a U.S. citizen still has to ask the U.S. to do the bare minimum. There wasn't anything of substance." Blinken told the family that their most pressing request, an independent U.S. investigation of the killing, was outside the scope of the State Department's authority and that he could not refer the case to the Justice Department, which would need to authorize such an inquiry. Abu Aghla said, "The entire time there was a lot of deflection, a lack of answer." Since the visit with Blinken, the family has not heard from him, and despite his reassurances that he would keep them informed, they learned from the news that he had asked the Israeli regime to expedite a conclusion to its own investigation. "But that's not what we ask him," said Abu Aghla, adding, "because we know how that's going to turn out. We are not expecting anything from the Israelis. What we are expecting is the U.S. to do its job." The U.S. State Department did not respond to a request for comment. The Justice Department declined to comment. While in Washington last month, the Abu Aghlas also met with more than a dozen members of Congress, several of whom spoke publicly in support of the family's quest for justice. Those meetings followed a flurry of statements and legislative efforts in the weeks and months since Abu Aghla's killing. To date, such efforts have included a letter led by Democratic representatives Andre Carson of Indiana, Lou Correa of California, and Bill Pascrell of New Jersey, signed by 57 members of Congress calling on the U.S. State Department and FBI to investigate the killing, as well as a similar letter by Senator Chris Van Hollen and 23 other senators. After the U.S. State Department issued a widely criticized statement on the killing over the July 4th holiday, Van Hollen and others issued a new letter, asking a detailed list of questions about the U.S. government's response to the killing. Separately, Democratic Senators Cory Booker and Bob Menendez of New Jersey, where Abu Aghla had been a resident, also sent a letter requesting a senior-level classified briefing on the investigation details, including American involvement. Meanwhile, Carson introduced an amendment to the defense budget, supported by other progressive members of Congress seeking to enforce a U.S. investigation into Abu Aghla's killing and any U.S. defense material implicated in it. After that failed, Carson announced standalone legislation seeking the same outcome. While these proposals aim to force the U.S. government to address Abu Aghila's killing, they are fairly limited in scope and don't address broader systematic human rights violations by the Zionist regime that the U.S. government could also address under existing U.S. laws, including foreign assistance and arms exports legislation. Abu Aghilas are not the first American family dealing with the U.S. government's inaction in the aftermath of a killing by Israeli regime forces. Last month, The Intercept published a long feature about the years-long crusade by the family of Rachel Corrie, an American peace activist killed in Gaza in 2003, to lobby U.S. officials for justice in vain. The Corries chose to break their silence about their private conversations with U.S. officials precisely because they feared that Abu Aghila family would be forced to endure the same ordeal. They shouldn't have to be asking the exact same questions we were asking in 2003, Sarah Corrie, Rachel's sister, told Intercept, adding, "My question to Biden administration is, what are you doing differently for Shireen's family that you didn't do in our case so that they will get accountability?" After their meetings in Washington last month, the Abu Aghilas felt that they had strong allies on the Hill, Lina Abu Aghila said. But so far, there has been no progress. The statements of support marked significant momentum around the cause that many in Washington have long been reticent to embrace, but they are only statements for now. "We told the family, after this trip, everything's just going to come to a screening halt, and it's going to be on us to build it back up again," said Brad Parker, a legislative consultant at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has been working with Abu Aghilas to coordinate meetings with U.S. officials, adding, "These narrow events over the years since Rachel's killing created these moments where it feels like there is this really significant step forward on the policy front, but then it doesn't really translate into concrete action. This is maybe the biggest test." For their part, the Abu Aghilas plan to continue to lobby the U.S. government for action with what Lina Abu Aghila described as a mixture of skepticism and hope. If the U.S. does not want to conduct an investigation, what does this say? It gives the green light for other governments to target U.S. citizens, U.S. journalists, without any accountability? Our hope right now lies in the hands of the members of Congress who have the power to make a change. So, in a way, we are hopeful, but the U.S. could have done something from day one, and they chose not to do.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of Islamic Laws. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're joined by Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, brother, for accepting our invitation. Well, dear audience, on this series of this program, we are going to talk about the Islamic rules regarding khums, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Welcome back to your audience of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Laws by me, Mahdi, and our dear expert, Sheikh Javid. Well, as the first question regarding khums, we have, are gifts and Eid presents subject to khums? Of course, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is, of course, important to note that when it comes to gifts or presents or souvenirs, the religious or authorities or the maraji have different opinions. For example, His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view there is that khums is not payable on gifts and presents. Given on the or received on the day of Eid, for example, or
gift,
or on any other occasion, because you receive gifts or you give gifts to people. When you receive gifts, khums is not payable on it, even if a year or many years pass on the on the gift. And of course, this issue is as contentious. Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that khums is not and cannot be paid on gifts, but there are religious authorities. For example, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that khums should be paid on gifts if a year runs over the gifts.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, if a year passes over the gifts, khums should be paid, otherwise khums is not payable. And of course, when you receive a gift, a gift could be in the form of cash, it could be in the form of an object or something, an item that yes. you receive. Ayatollah Khamenei says, no matter what kind of gift you receive, whether it is in the form of cash or something like that, it is an object, even if you do not use it, and if it remains unused in your house or in your box, it remains there for over
for
1 year.
For more than a year.
Yeah. Khums is not payable on it, but some other religious authorities are of the view that if it remains unused for more than a year, then khums should be paid from it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, dear Sheikh. And now the next question: is khums applicable to prizes given by the banks and riba-free loan institutions to their customers?
Well, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, the position is the same with regards to prizes and gifts given by the banks. Of course, the banks do give prizes to their customers in order to encourage them
to put their money in bank.
Yeah, the position is the same. The ruling is the same as gifts received by an individual. The same ruling applies to the prizes that you may receive from a bank. Therefore, khums is not payable on the prize as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you, dear Sheikh. Dear audience, let's take a break. We'll be right back.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Welcome back to your audience of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Laws with me, Mahdi, and our dear expert, Sheikh Javid. Well, as the next question we have, when it comes to khums evasion, there are some people who try to evade it. For example, in order to evade payment of khums on their assets, a husband and wife give each other their annual income as gifts prior to the end of their khums year. Please explain the rule concerning their liability to khums.
As I said in my answer to the previous question, of course, these people who try to evade khums are not exempted from the obligatory khums by this type of gift, because no matter what what it looks to be in common view, everything depends on the intention of the donor or in the intention of the two parties, the husband and the wife,
uh-huh.
in this case. And of course, if it is intended to evade giving khums, then the husband or the wife should pay khums from their assets. And tax evasion is not allowed in Sharia law. And those who are supposed to pay khums, they must pay khums from their assets. And of course, khums should be paid from the asset over which 1 year has passed.
Uh-huh.
Now, when it comes to how one should calculate the year, of course, khums should be paid from the first. Khums should be paid from on the savings over which 1 year has passed. For example, if you started working last year at the same time, now this year at the same time, you should calculate your khums and your savings. Uh-huh. And in the event that a year has passed over the savings, or maybe in the event that you have some savings, you must pay khums from the savings or from your
assets. And 1/5 of it, you mean?
Now, some people, you know, save their money and they don't have any jobs. Of course, in that case, we should see whether 1 year has passed over their savings or not. If a year has actually passed over their savings, they have to pay khums from the savings. And if you have a regular job with a stable source of income, you should start calculating khums from the day you started working and from the day you earned your money. The first salary that you received is the first day of your khums. Mm-hmm. And next year on the same day, you should calculate your khums and see how much is your balance and how much you have your savings.
Could you let us know how to calculate our khums?
Well, it depends on how much you have in your savings account, okay? Uh-huh. Now, for example, if you have $1,000 in your account, mm-hmm. you have to pay 1/5 of it, which is $200.
Uh-huh. As 1/5 of our income.
Yeah, 1/5 of your savings, not your income, yeah, because part of your income goes towards funding or supporting your family.
Uh-huh, that's right.
And part of it might be saved up in your account. So you have to pay 1/5 of the savings. And of course, then that 1/5 is divided into two portions. Uh-huh. One portion is considered to be Sahmi Imam, and the other portion is considered to be Sahmi Sadat. Okay? Uh-huh. So these, the first portion, the portion which belongs to the Sadat, it should be given to the Sayyids with the permission of the religious authority. Uh-huh. Now, it depends on who you are following. If you are following His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, you should obtain his permission or the permission of his authorized representative. That's because right. He has got authorized representatives all over the world. So you have to go to him and ask his permission in order to give that portion of khums to needy Sayyids whom you have identified.
That's right.
And when it comes to the portion of Imam, again, you will definitely need the permission of your religious authority or the permission of a qualified religious authority. And of course, you're always supposed to follow the most qualified religious authority. Uh-huh. And of course, if you're following Ayatollah Khamenei as the most qualified religious authority, you should seek his permission. You should obtain his ijazah. And also, if he's not available or he's not accessible, of course, you should obtain the ijazah of his wakil or his representative. Uh-huh. And in the event that he gives his permission, you can give that portion of khums also to any needy families.
That portion of Imam.
The portion of Imam, of course, the Sahmi Imam, okay? Mm-hmm. To give it or to spend it on the most essential areas. Like, for example, helping the poor, reaching out to the needy people, building mosques or bridges and utilities, whatever. Yeah,
depending upon the idea of the experts, which we refer to, actually.
Of course. No, first of all, you go to the religious authority with your details and explanation, okay? Mm-hmm. There's a mosque which is being built, and of course, it's in need of funds. Mm-hmm. The people are poor. They cannot build the mosque with their own funds because mm-hmm. they are poor, and they are too poor to help or to build the mosque. Now, we are in need of some money.
Some fund.
And if you allow us to collect funds, of course, we will collect it, mm-hmm. and we will spend the fund or the Sahmi Imam on reconstructing or renovating uh-huh. the mosque. And if the religious authority or the mujtahid whom you follow allows it, then of course you can go ahead and spend it on that area.
Thank you, dear brother Sheikh Jawid, for your nice answers. And thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And you can follow us on social media. Just type Call of Islam Radio. Until our next episode, fi amanallah and goodbye.
سميع بصير لا إله إلا قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio.